Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Intercom Communications. I'm Lee Rogers in for Chris Evans. Our guest today is Dr. Saria Sarcosio. Good day to you, Doctor.
Hey, good afternoon.
Dr. Saria Sarcosio is the Ambulatory Chief Medical Officer of Prisma Health, and I believe at last count we are up to episode 16 of the COVID Chronicles. Doctor, first thing I wanted to discuss with you, one of the things that I've seen throughout this whole pandemic here is our State Department of Health and Environmental Control, DHEC, has done a really good job of communicating, I think, with the public and getting data out there. And we had an issue that came up on July 8th. There was a part of their news release, and they made a little asterisk to their number of confirmed deaths for the pandemic for that date. And what they said was today's 38 deaths included some deaths of individuals who were delayed in being reported to DHEC since June 24th. The agency is reiterating to healthcare facilities and providers across the state that all COVID-19-related deaths must be reported to DHEC by phone within 24 hours. This in accordance with South Carolina list of reportable conditions. I know that you're not necessarily with the Department of Health and Environmental Control there, but how can something like this happen from a hospital standpoint? How is it that this data would be held for such a long period of time?
Well, we have seen this happen across the country, Lee. There are certain pockets of where positive tests are distributed and sent to the local health department, and we also see that with deaths. And the reason for that is we want to make sure that we are clear and confirmed with the true cause of death. In any case, the true cause of death is very important, but especially so when you're speaking about COVID-19, communicable diseases, and ensuring that we have an accurate count. So sometimes you may be waiting for an autopsy. You may be waiting for test results. And getting all of those reports sent to DHEC is critical in a timely manner, no doubt. But if you anticipate the number, you mentioned 38 across the entire state of South Carolina, that does not surprise me if sometimes we see what's called a data dump.
Well, I mean, that to me, to hear you explain it that way, it does seem somewhat understandable that there could be some delays sometimes in reporting this. And I believe one other time during this pandemic, I have seen the State Department of Health and Environmental Control make reference to the fact that some of the data has been delayed. So this isn't the first time that has happened, but it has an impact, I believe, on the way that the situation is perceived. And I know that there's a political pull to the left and right on this, obviously, but because it does have an impact on how it is perceived and the importance of it and the accuracy of the data. I guess that goes to your point that it's very important we get it right, and then sometimes it just requires the data to be a little bit slow coming in there. But I was just sort of wondering how that could happen, but that makes sense from an organizational standpoint that you could have situations where the data does seem to be coming in a bit slow than anticipated.
Yeah, certainly. And we see the same thing with the CDC. And we've learned the hard way when there were inappropriate interpretations of tests and numbers came out that may not have been accurate. And the CDC had to go back and refine how they received those results. So we see this throughout the system. And again, correcting those numbers and making sure that we are sharing a story with the United States and the American citizens is critical.
Now, looking at the release, and we'll get off the DHEC data here shortly, but I just wanted to go by this with you because this is something that I think is of interest to folks. DHEC today, as of July 10th, is reporting from yesterday, July 9th, there were 1,723 new confirmed cases, one new probable case, 22 additional confirmed deaths, and this brings the total number of confirmed cases as of Thursday to 50,548. They list probable cases at 143. The thing that I find interesting is that we have pretty much four counties that seem to always be the top, and that would be Charleston, Greenville, Horry County, and Richland County. Is this simply a function of population, or are there other factors at play here?
So my answer would be yes.
That's what I thought.
The reason why I give a blanket yes is there are numerous factors that contribute to those numbers. For one, the population, yes. As we see the rapid increase in the rate of individuals from the ages of 20 to 40 with COVID-19 positive tests. And if you look at the population and demographics across these cities, you would see some consistency. And who is socializing? Who is not perhaps social distancing, perhaps not wearing masks? And where you have these larger populations and you have more retail, more restaurants and bars, you will likely at this time see an increase in the COVID-19 cases.
Now, this also, though, if you look at those counties, Charleston, Greenville, Horry, and Richland County, these would be areas where you may get some out-of-state visitors coming as well, wouldn't you think?
Absolutely, and that would be another factor that we need to consider. We know that people are on their summer vacations, and frankly, citizens are just tired. Citizens are tired and worn out with COVID-19. They just want to get back to living. Hence, we tend to let our guard down when we're on vacation. We're around a different group of individuals. Perhaps we are going to more restaurants than we normally would if we were staying at home. So all of those factors are contributing to the challenges that we're seeing now.
Now, speaking of groups of individuals, and I know this may be a bit of a difficult question, but how do health officials account for what apparently is a racial disparity in the infections and the outcomes for minority groups when compared with Caucasian groups? I guess what I'm trying to get to, is this truly a situation where health care is being denied, or there's not a parity of care, or are there other factors at play, or both?
I would say the same this time. Yes, and both would be my answer for a number of reasons. What we are seeing across the country is this great disparity between the deaths of African Americans and other ethnic groups. And we don't have all the answers to that. We're not sure why perhaps the response is different. When we look at who is being tested, we do now have adequate testing across all of the demographics now through our community testing sites that we're offering within all neighborhoods. And we have been hotspotting or identifying the zip code areas where we have seen an increase in COVID-19 cases and going to the communities to test. So we know that there's access to testing. It's not just that some are being tested more than others. We definitely recognize the mortality rate is different, and this has been echoed across the country. So we're scratching our heads. We don't have all the answers. However, we have also seen similar situations, for example, with heart attacks or strokes or certain other diseases. Sometimes we wonder, is it an access in care or is it a lack of trust in care? And that's sometimes what we see with these conditions. Perhaps someone is waiting longer at home for fear that going to an emergency department or seeking care may expose them, or it might confirm that they do indeed have COVID-19 or some other illness. So for so many reasons, we don't have all of the answers, but there are a number of factors that are playing into the numbers that we're seeing today. And what I will say finally about this is it is very concerning. And you, like myself, have probably heard Dr. Fauci speak to this, the ultimate expert on COVID-19 at this point in all infectious diseases, is it's unacceptable. It's a disparity, and we've got to identify the reasons why and correct them.
Also, with the recent increase of new cases there, are healthcare workers seeing a greater increase in infections, particularly here in our area?
Yes, just like anyone else in our communities, we are seeing a rise in the number of healthcare workers who are being infected with COVID-19. However, it is typically not a transmission from a patient. Where we're seeing the significant majority of these positive cases in healthcare workers is whether it's in a social space or perhaps with their colleagues. So we are reiterating, as we are with the community, we're doing the same within our health systems to remind everyone to keep their guard up, to keep their mask on, to maintain social distance, and to continue to wash their hands, because everyone is at risk. And the greater the number of cases in our communities, of course, the greater your exposure in all environments, whether it's work or social.
Now, as the pandemic began, we heard all the horror stories of the shortages of the PPE, the personal protective equipment there. And I've seen some stories recently where there's becoming a shortage again. Have you seen any of that here in our area?
In our communities in South Carolina, we are not seeing a PPE, our personal protective equipment, shortage. So we have ample gowns and N95 masks and surgical masks. So we feel very comfortable that we have adequate supply. We still have adequate supply of testing materials. However, I think it is important for our listeners to know that it's not a limitless supply. So what do I mean by that? While we are testing hundreds of people, if not thousands a day, in our local communities here for COVID-19, it's important that we are ensuring we have plenty of tests for those who are symptomatic, those who've had a very high risk of exposure. What we are challenged with is we are seeing many people who perhaps have no symptoms, no exposure, who have a curiosity, And it's really important that we have access to everyone for those testing supplies, but we're going to have to be mindful about how we use those.
Now, are we seeing a shortage now of hospital beds or the ventilators? Because that, too, was one of the early issues about a shortage of that nationwide.
We currently have plenty of hospital beds available, including ICU beds and ventilators. I know that we have more ventilators on the way as we purchased additional equipment to anticipate the increase in surge and increased need that arises. But still currently, and we watch this every day, the projections show that we will have adequate supply. So again, we'll continue to watch those numbers and watch them very carefully.
Now, staying on that supply theme, as we get past the summer months and into the fall, how is, if you can project this, how would a normal flu season affect our healthcare system capacity?
Well, as you can imagine, Lee, this is a conversation that is occurring at a daily level at this point in many of our rooms and with our leadership at Prisma Health. It's something that we're beginning to prepare for the next coming months. It's something we're concerned about. It's also something we want to make sure we're prepared for. As you could imagine, what the viral symptoms for flu show up as are the same symptoms that you can experience with COVID-19. So it will be important that we are vaccinating as many individuals with the flu vaccine to help prevent that illness to begin with, because it will be a challenging season for us. And anyone over the age of 6 months should be vaccinated with the flu vaccine.
Now, I did see a story, once again, I can't confirm this, but just from what I was reading in one of the news outlets, a patient was diagnosed as having COVID-19 and the flu simultaneously. Is that a possibility?
Absolutely. And the more we learn about COVID-19 and this viral illness, we will likely see more co-infection or being infected with both the flu and COVID-19 as a possibility. So just because you get a flu test that's positive for flu does not mean that you do not also have COVID-19. We will have to be hypervigilant this season to ensure that everyone is receiving proper care, that they're preventing flu to begin with, so we minimize that viral burden or viral disease within our communities so that we are amply prepared and have adequate resources.
Do you think anything in the current situation is going to help you to anticipate any procedural changes you may need to make for the next flu season?
Yes, as we begin to look at our testing supplies and how we test for flu and how we test for COVID-19 and which locations will be available for testing, we want to ensure that we continue to have the ease of access and the convenience that we've offered thus far in our community testing sites around South Carolina, in addition to our drive-through testing sites at our hospital facilities. So we anticipate that in the fall, we will continue to require to provide that level of care.
Now, turning to face masks or face coverings, as it has been discussed a lot, I know that you and Chris on this program have discussed that many times, but I just wondered if you have any idea about the effectiveness of the clear plastic face shields, because that's been mentioned possibly for use by teachers so that students can actually see the teacher, because it's sort of difficult to follow along if you know, half your face is covered. And there's sort of a psychological issue about, a masked teacher at the class, and that the students may feel more comfortable, particularly the younger ones, if they're actually able to see the facial expression, what the teacher is saying. What about the effectiveness of the clear plastic shields that cover the whole face?
That is an excellent question, and I have not seen the data that has validated that they are any safer or as safe as our cloth masks or our paper masks. So I would anticipate over the next coming weeks that that will become an area of focus for research. And I do believe that as we develop more information, it will be helpful and we will identify additional resources that can be used. Because, yes, I can understand, particularly with the younger school-age students that will be going back to the classroom, that there may be some who are uncomfortable or concerned, and being able to connect socially, we know body language is the significant majority of how we communicate as human beings. That is very important to make that social contact and to enhance the educational environment. However, the skinny of that response would be we still need more research, and hopefully that will be coming soon.
Just some anecdotal evidence. I was at, I believe, one of the Costco stores recently, and one of their workers was wearing, she had the face shield on, she had the mask on, and the gloves, so... I think she was pretty well covered there, so hopefully she did quite well there. We've talked somewhat about contact tracing, and is that being conducted now, or as positive tests are coming through, or who's responsible for that and who's following up on that?
That is an excellent question, and one I do believe in the state of South Carolina we have been somewhat challenged with having adequate contact tracing available to everyone and anyone who's had a positive COVID-19 test. And as we see realistically, that becomes more and more challenging as we see the number of cases rise and the level of work effort that increases dramatically with the number of cases that now have to be tracked back. We are also seeing pockets of contact tracing. Of course, we do the same within our Prisma Health organization to ensure that those who are at high risk of exposure can then be further evaluated. It is a challenge when the prevalence rates, as I was mentioning, are as high as they are today, but something that is definitely worthwhile and help identify those who are at greatest risk to self-quarantine and isolate to prevent others from being infected.
On that topic, are we able to tell where some of these new cases are coming from? I mean, are people getting infected at grocery stores, bars, restaurants, or at church? Do we know?
Once again, the blanket answer is yes. People are being infected in all of these locations across the community, and they're also being prevented in all of those locations and across communities. It is important that we recognize it is everyone's responsibility to keep our community safe. So what does that look like? That means proper hand washing. That means social distancing, at least 6 feet from one another, wearing masks. What we know about the masks is they can prevent respiratory droplets from passing in the air and infecting others. So that's something that I know that people have been challenged with or frustrated with or don't feel comfortable in a mask. And at this point, it has become even more critical that we do so and that we are hypervigilant, because we all want our businesses to remain open. We all would like to see students and children safely go back to school.
Has there been, speaking of school, has there been any indication of any outbreaks at daycare centers? And I asked that because around, particularly the upstate, the daycare centers did not shut down. The state did not require it, and many of them remained open. And have we seen any outbreaks there, either from the staff or from the children themselves?
Yes, we have. There have been pockets across South Carolina where child care locations have had positive COVID-19 cases, whether it's the child or it's the daycare worker or perhaps a parent of a child. All of those situations have occurred, and we see that minimized when people are keeping their distance and also ensuring that masks are consistently worn and we are washing our hands regularly.
Now, as of Friday, Governor McMaster has issued a new executive order. He referred to it as last call, which is banning the sale of alcohol in bars and restaurants after 11 p.m. And he cited what he considered to be the bad behavior, so to speak, of younger adults that are still out partying and obviously imbibing in adult beverages. Do you think this will be effective? Do you think this is a good idea?
Well, time will tell what this restriction will cost for us. I also see that we are not following our preventive measures during the day as well. So coronavirus lives during the day. Coronavirus lives at night. I do agree that the more alcoholic beverages that you do ingest, you're less likely to make proper preventive measure decisions. However, people can become inebriated prior to 11 p.m. So again, time will tell what we see, what we learn, but at least it's a step in the right direction of trying to control social behaviors in our communities.
I know one of the things that was mentioned early on in when this began back in the winter and early spring is that when the summer months come, this is going to die down. It seems to have gotten worse, or at least the number of infections we're getting seem to be increasing. And obviously, you know, some people will attribute that to more testing, but it's also because more people are becoming infected. And I'm just wondering what happened to that theory. Has it been disproved? Is this not like the flu, which does tend to die down or subside somewhat during the warmer months and then come back in the colder months?
I will say that I was no different than anyone else in the late winter, early spring, and was very hopeful that the summer would kill off, if you will, COVID-19. However, we definitely have not seen that play out. And the reasoning for that, there's a couple of thoughts for that. One is what we know about COVID-19, it is much more infectious than the flu. So that's one challenge. Two, We saw so many people that were pinned up at home, not leaving their homes, not socializing at all. And what's different with flu seasons is while we see increased rates in the winter and we attribute that to more people being inside, therefore respiratory droplets more likely to travel, but you don't see people go crazy in the summer because of the flu has kept people cooped up and self-isolated. So what's happened, and personally experienced and observing on the beaches, is you have groups of individuals, 10, 20 people who come together. They are all flocking to the same hotel rooms. You'll have numerous people in one hotel room, and then they'll go to the restaurant, and we're not wearing masks. So where perhaps the flu season may be different, not as infectious, and the behaviors are very different, everyone is fitting in their summer vacations, including their spring break vacations and perhaps winter vacations, because so many people stayed home before and they're just wanting to get out. So we're perhaps not practicing the same behaviors that we would otherwise.
Speaking of getting out, what are you thinking about sports coming up? I mean, we're looking at high school football. Obviously, the Greenville County School District has still got some issues, and they are postponing some of the practices and things. We've got college football coming up. We've got the NFL. What are your thoughts about that happening and there being fans, and then, of course, then the exposure that the athletes would have with coaches, staff, and other people?
There are definitely some very serious risks that we need to consider. However, I also recognize that universities and professional leagues are weighing the benefits and the concerns of not going forward with sports in the coming seasons. And I recently heard this week a podcast from Dr. Fauci, again, one of our world experts for infectious disease, in particular COVID-19. And he was very clear in his guidance, so I'm going to offer the same. He is perhaps a medical expert in COVID-19, not an expert in sports, professional or college level. So I would leave that to the experts that are making those decisions. What I would say is important is that it's critical that there is a pathway in place for what to do when COVID-19 positive cases occur. How do we protect the individual athletes? How do we keep them safe and healthy? How do we protect the other team members that may be exposed to them personally on their team? And specifically with contact sports such as football and basketball and others, where they can then spread the illness to other team members or other teams that then the following week, the following Friday or Saturday, play another team and spread to another community. All of those decisions and pathways must have a clear direction, and what do we do in those situations? It's not an easy answer, and I can only imagine how difficult of a decision this is.
And
for our leaders,
if you think about fans attending, that really complicates things, doesn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, I don't see a safe environment where fans could be in the stands at these games. I don't think we have that level of safety today, at least, for tailgating in the sense that we recall and remember tailgating in 2019. There will definitely have to be adjustments made. And so I'll be very interested to see how we handle college football this season. What does that mean, and what do the experts tell us?
Well, one thing's for sure, this whole pandemic is certainly transforming our society, isn't it?
It certainly is in so many ways, and there is absolutely no way possible that we could have anticipated just how different our lives would be in 2020 than they were in 2019.
Well, Doctor, thank you much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Always my pleasure, Lee.
And for more information on the latest coronavirus news, just go to 1063WORD.com. Our guest has been Dr. Saria Sarcosio. I'm Lee Rogers, and for Chris Evans, this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.